2 weeks and 2 days from now, we'll wake up and, barring unforeseen circumstances, which are certainly possible, know who will be president come January 20th of 2013. Tonight, though, voters will get one last chance to hear from President Barack Obama and his GOP opponent, Mitt Romney, as the two go head-to-head in the third and final presidential debate. On tap tonight, foreign policy. In particular, what to do in Afghanistan and Pakistan and how to deal with Israel and Iran, the new face of terrorism and trade with China, topics chosen by moderator and CBS News chief Washington correspondent Bob Schieffer. Tonight's debate will be held in Boca Raton, Florida at 9 p.m. You can hear it on 89.7 FM and watch it on Channel 34, WOSU Television on Channel 34, and follow all of our campaign coverage at WOSU.org. A little later, we'll be joined by political reporters from Florida and Colorado to find out what voters in those two swing states are talking about. But first, joining me now is David Steben. He's associate professor of history and law at Ohio State. Welcome to the show, David.
Nice to be here.
So let's listen to some sound from the last debate. Last week, the candidates verbally sparred about how the president and his cabinet handled the attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, which resulted in the deaths of four Americans.
That the president, the day after that happened, flies to Las Vegas for a political fundraiser, then the next day to Colorado for another event, another political event. I think these actions taken by a president and a leader have symbolic significance and perhaps even material significance, in that you'd hope that during that time we could call in the people who were actually eyewitnesses. We've read their accounts now about what happened. It was very clear this was not a demonstration. This was an attack by terrorists.
The day after the attack, Governor, I stood in the Rose Garden and I told the American people and the world that we are going to find out exactly what happened, that this was an act of terror. And I also said that we're going to hunt down those who committed this crime. And the suggestion that anybody in my team, whether the Secretary of State, our UN ambassador, anybody on my team would play politics or mislead when we've lost four of our own, Governor, is offensive. That's not what we do. That's not what I do as president. That's not what I do as commander-in-chief.
To me, one of the obvious zingers in the program that night. David Steben, what did you make of that? You agree that the president pretty much, if you want to put it this way, won the debate that time.
At least for the time being. They'll probably bring it up again tonight. And it shows Governor Romney's lesser degree of experience with foreign policy issues. It's really hard to get foreign policy experience without doing it, right? And so we tend to elect governors or former governors as our president because they're chief executives before they're the president. And, of course, Governor Romney has been a governor, and he's been in charge of things. He's used to being in charge of things. But he has no experience in this national security area, and as a result, he doesn't ask questions or make comments with the same laser-like precision that he often does when he's talking about economics, things like that, the business world, about which he knows a lot. And so that comment of his, it was very clear after the fact that this was a terrorist attack. It was very clear ultimately. It wasn't very clear immediately. And so there is a way of kind of criticizing the president's team for being somewhat confused about what this really was initially. But it's a difficult thing to do because you can look really bad, as though you're attempting to make cheap political advantage out of a tragedy. And in fact, former Ambassador Stevens' father has asked Governor Romney to stop talking about this. In other words, that it shouldn't become a partisan political football. So it creates a more perilous sort of set of choices for Romney going forward.
But does it tell the American voters anything they need to know about Mitt Romney's ability to lead as an international leader, not just as a national leader, not just as an executive of a country, but as a national leader in the world?
Right. Well, what Governor Romney is trying to communicate subtly is that he would be a more engaged and decisive national security manager than the president, that the president's too passive. And, you know, we have a history of foreign policy debates. The first set of televised presidential debates in 1960 featured a foreign policy debate. And I've watched this thing from beginning to end. I learned far more about Kimoi and Matsu than I ever wanted to know. These tiny little islands off the coast of the People's Republic of China. So why all this talk about Kimoi and Matsu and defending them? Because both candidates, Vice President Nixon and Senator Kennedy, wanted to communicate that they would be the stronger and more decisive without being provocative or restless. That sweet spot. And that's where Governor Romney is trying to go using this Benghazi episode. That I will be a more engaged on a daily basis and stronger leader of American interests in the world without overdoing it. And the implied criticism of President Obama is, again, he's a nice man, but not dynamic enough, too passive. And so that's why his administration was sort of behind the curve in terms of guarding against this scenario and then responding to it after the fact. Now, it's the trouble with this argument from Governor Romney is, of course, that he doesn't have a lot of experience doing this. So the notion that he is ready on day one to do it better than the incumbent is, I think, for most swing voters in Ohio, a tough sell. Interestingly, what it means in terms of tonight's debate is in some ways Governor Romney has a lower bar. The expectations for him are lower. So if he does a good job in this debate, and he's done a good job in almost every debate he's ever been in, he's been in a lot of them because of all those primary debates, then that could help him. But it's the biggest doubt I think voters, swing voters generally have about non-incumbents without any foreign policy experience. And the other thing is this business world gives you leadership training, and the people in it tend to be at the high level very smart, but they can be out of their depth in national security. And if one thinks back to Vice President Cheney, Vice President Cheney had a background to some degree in government, but he had also been a Fortune 500 CEO. And he brought that kind of decisiveness and strength to the vice presidency, but with unhappy results in terms of our foreign policy from the point of view of swing voters. In other words, he's sort of reckless, aimed too high in Iraq. The results were not positive, right? So the last thing that small pool of swing voters wants is a return to that act and think through the consequences later approach.
I don't want to go off on the Cheney thing, but it's interesting when you put it in that perspective that they weren't more results oriented, that they weren't more oriented toward outcomes and what they would do when the statues started falling and that sort of thing in Iraq. That was the surprising part of the whole thing, is how unprepared they were.
They had unrealistic assumptions. By the way, the first bit of foreign policy criticism of that to emerge from Governor Romney the last time when he was in the debates and so forth in 08, his gentle comment about the Cheney, Bush-Cheney approach in Iraq was the next steps after the invasion of Iraq were underplanned. One word, and a kind of cautious word, and I think most people would agree, not enough planning. This chief White House spokesperson fired back the same day, and this is in the Bush administration, saying, what does Governor Romney know about foreign policy? So there's been this rap on him, even within the Republican Party from the beginning. And he, I think, he's a very well-educated person. He's a very smart person, Governor Romney, and he's a very well-spoken person. So I don't think he'll turn in a bad performance tonight. But he doesn't have the same kind of nuance in this area that he has in economic issues.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Ken in Marysville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to state that by reading the transcripts of President Obama in the Rose Garden, he did use the words act of terror. But in my opinion, he was clearly speaking about 9/11. So to say that he won that part of the debate wouldn't make sense to me when he used his own words out of context. And to say that Romney has little or no experience with foreign policy, I cannot recall a president we've elected with less experience in government than President Obama.
So the voter, but once they have them in there, are they going to get rid of them is the question when the alternative.
Right. Well, and people, voters are more sensitive to this issue because they elected George W. Bush in 2000, and he had very little experience in national security matters, and it didn't go well, right? And on that side, from the point of view of swing voters, in other words, that whatever one thinks of President Bush Jr.'s domestic policy achievements, the foreign policy, the principal foreign policy issue, the sort of handling of the war in the Middle East, by the election day in 08, most swing voters were very unhappy. And so this, and in terms of President Obama, his background, agreed, he doesn't have a lot of background, but he served in the Senate. And the Senate has to deal with national security and foreign policy issues. Governor Romney has been a governor. And by definition, you simply don't get much engagement with foreign policy issues in that job. And so he's had some background in trade internationally, you know, doing business in China and elsewhere. But that's nothing like the government-to-government negotiating process. So even, in other words, none of these are intended to be partisan statements. Even leading Republicans in the foreign policy area have been shaking their heads over the past year at some of Governor Romney's statements in debates with other Republicans. And, for example, in one at one point in the campaign and during the primaries, Governor Romney said about Afghanistan, it's very simple. We need to stay in Afghanistan, we need to kill them all, meaning all of the terrorists, and we need to win. And even the George W. Bush foreign policy officials were sort of shaking their heads at that one. That's too simplistic, right? And so, I mean, I suspect that if Governor Romney is elected, he will learn on the job.
And he'll hire some people on his cabinet.
What makes people nervous, who are truly independent swing voters, is that period when he's learning on the job, right? And you can really see it in the response from our allies, from the British, the Germans, and so on. They're not eager to swap what they have, the relationship they have with the Obama administration, for an untested new Republican president, especially given what happened the last time. They didn't like... The allies did not like the Bush-Cheney foreign policy.
Yeah, you know, Ken, I agree with you about the remarks in the Rose Garden. It was more of a generic reference to terrorism,
right.
But the point that was being made by using it was that overall that was a big zinger moment in the debate, whether you understood all the context or not, and that's why I used it that way. But I get exactly what you're saying, Ken.
Thank you.
Yeah, take care.
Okay.
We are going to continue our conversation leading up to the third and final debate between President Barack Obama and his GOP challenger Mitt Romney tonight in Boca Raton, Florida, very Tony part of the world, with my guest, David Stebbins. He's an associate professor of history and law at OSU. And coming up, we'll also be joined by a reporter from Florida to talk about what voters are talking about in that swing state. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Got dinner table discussion, water cooler chat, even pillow talk, but how often are you part of the national conversation? I'm Neil Conan. Raise your voice on everything from the news of the day to the twists and turns of culture and history on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Support for 89.7 comes from Marburn Academy, a forward-thinking school for ADHD and dyslexic students hosting a community parent seminar, Understanding the Problems of ADHD Children, Tuesday, October 30th at 7 p.m. The path to college begins at Marburn Academy. More at marburnacademy.org. And support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's John Glenn School of Public Affairs, offering continuing education and graduate degree programs designed for the working professional. More details about the programs and upcoming information sessions are online at glenn.osu.edu. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Now in a cliffhanger race against Republican challenger Mitt Romney, Barack Obama will sweep through Iowa on Wednesday, then hit Colorado, Nevada, Florida and Virginia, cast his ballot early in his hometown of Chicago, then stop in, of course, Ohio to end this latest tour. The third and final presidential debate is tonight in Boca Raton, Florida, critical swing state in this election. Joining me now to preview the debate and how things sit in Florida is Jessica Palumbo. She covers politics for NPR affiliate WFSU in Tallahassee. Welcome to the show, Jessica.
Great to be here, Anne.
Also still with us is OSU history and law professor David Stebbin. Once again, David, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
So, Jessica, some Republicans are confident that Mitt Romney's recent surge in the polls post-debate two has locked in the three key southern swing states for the GOP ticket, North Carolina, Virginia, and Florida. Does Florida appear locked in at this point?
Well, and I think if you look at the range of polls that we have here in Florida, some of those do put Mitt Romney up with a lead of 5. Fox News has him up at 3. But if you average those out, he's with a 2% lead right now in the polls. Now, there's a lot of other factors that we can look at that both campaigns really don't think it is a lock at this point. Obama is going to be campaigning hard in Florida the rest of this week. And if you look at a lot of different numbers, you might have a different result. Like registration numbers in Florida right now, Democrats outnumber Republicans by more than 500,000. If you look at the absentee ballots that have already been cast in Florida, Republicans are up by 6%. But the Obama campaign likes to point out that at this point in 2008, they had a 17-point lead in those absentee ballots for the Republicans. So it's really still anybody's game at this point in Florida.
But history hasn't necessarily been kind to Democrats in Florida. They've won only 3 times in 40 years, I think. Barack Obama in 08, Bill Clinton in 96, and Jimmy Carter in 76.
That's right.
So, well, let's talk about the issues. I know that economically, Florida is not faring as well as Ohio has been faring. Is it that much bigger of an issue, therefore?
That's true. In Florida, we are still at an 8.7% unemployment, and that is what Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney and his campaign are hitting hard on their campaign stops here in South Florida recently, really talking about those jobs numbers and trying to hammer home that they'll be able to help solve that problem here.
Let's talk about Cuba. Always an issue in Florida, whereas it's not much of an issue maybe almost anywhere else. Thousands of Cuban Americans have taken advantage of Obama's decision in 2009 to allow them to make unlimited trips to visit relatives and send unlimited amounts of money. And in 2011, another set of rules allowed all Americans to take educational trips and religious missions to Cuba. A great opening up, but that doesn't seem to have done him much good, at least among the older generation of Cubans.
That's right. If you look at the numbers with Cuban Americans, especially in the Miami area, those people predominantly lean Republican still. But if you look at the Hispanic vote as a whole in Florida, you still have in Central Florida a large population of Puerto Rican Americans, and especially a lot of new Puerto Rican Americans who have moved to the state, especially Central Florida, since 2008. And the Obama campaign is really hoping that those people who tend to lean Democratic will sort of balance out the Cuban American vote in South Florida.
Yeah, I mean, more than even in 2008, the Hispanic vote, including Cuban vote, is going to come into play this year, David Stebbin?
Yes, although historically Latinos have turned out at a much lower rate than non-Latinos. Mm-hmm. And so one of the questions is this newer or younger generation more prone to vote? I was struck by the president's speech at the University of Miami in Coral Gables a couple of weeks ago. He drew a very large, very enthusiastic crowd, a lot of younger Latinos in that audience. So there is a sort of a new Latino vote in Florida as well as the older, heavily Cuban one. The problem, I think, in Florida is that economy. It's this undertow that's dragging down Democrats. And Ohio, in comparison, the other big electoral vote prize, has done a lot significantly better than Florida over the past 4 years. There's also the housing market issue, which is a lot worse still in Florida than it is here. And the two are related, right? If you don't have a better job, then it's hard for you to pay your mortgage. So the interesting thing about the first debate and the second debate for Governor Romney is that the pollsters report that it really helped him in the Deep South, improving his support among strongly conservative Republicans in that region, which he did not do well in during the primaries. There is a Deep South part of the Florida electorate, and that's north of Orlando. In other words, the farther north you go in Florida, the farther south you go in terms of the political culture. Mm-hmm. And in that part of the state, Romney is doing better now in terms of predicted turnout and so on. So he's in better shape in Florida than he is in Ohio. The challenge for him is he sort of needs both, probably, to win. And it's a much tougher sell up here in Ohio.
Jessica Palumbo, what do you think has to happen tonight for first Mitt Romney to succeed and achieve his goals in Florida and conversely Barack Obama?
Well,
are you there, Jessica?
Yes, okay. Yes, Ann, I am here. appealing to the Hispanic vote is going to be important for Mitt Romney to take over in Central Florida, the gains that Obama has there with the Hispanic mm-hmm. population.
What about there's another large community in Florida, and I think this is what you were talking about, David, in the southern Florida areas, is Jewish voters.
That's right.
How is Mitt Romney faring in that department?
Well, it's interesting. The farther south you go in Florida, the more northern the political culture is. Mm-hmm. A lot of transplanted New Yorkers. That Boca Raton area, where the debate is to be held tonight, has a lot of older Jewish voters who historically lean Democratic. But they're worried about Israel because Israel's always a concern for the American Jewish community, but the existential danger to the survival of the state of Israel seems greater now because of the hostility of Iran, its nuclear ambitions, and so on. And so they want a stronger stand from the American president and American government in defense of what they see as an increasingly isolated Israel, an endangered Israel. And that is Mitt Romney's opportunity. The problem is Israel isn't the only country in the region. It's a very turmoil-filled Middle East region. So the last thing you want to do is sound so pro-Israel that you cause other problems for the United States. So, again, that takes a lot of nuance to sound more strongly supportive of Israel than President Obama and the Democrats without doing something that creates other big troubles.
Jessica Palumbo, exit polls indicate that about three-quarters of Jewish voters in Florida and nationwide backed Obama in 2008. Is that enough of an edge that'll save him in that department this time around?
Well, it's really hard to say, given the Jewish percentage of the population in Florida, whether that's going to make a difference for Obama this time around. Really, what might make more of a difference is those young and first-time voters who came out in 2008, and we're really watching those people to see if they're going to be motivated to come back out and vote for him again this time around.
That Coral Gables audience that David was talking about earlier, was that primarily, were you there, was that primarily younger voters?
In that Coral Gables mm-hmm. audience is predominantly older voters.
Okay. All right. Very enthusiastic, though? Or
that's right. I watched it, the video.
Okay.
And the way the camera was set, I saw what looked to me like college students, mm-hmm. right? But it was a large and enthusiastic crowd. One is also struck from the vantage point of Central Ohio about how racially diverse Florida's electorate is when compared with older states in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And so that diversity in general is helpful to the president. I think your other guest is exactly right. Turnout is crucial. Younger voters were enthusiastic for the president 4 years ago. They have disproportionately suffered from unemployment and economic problems, and that has dampened their enthusiasm. If they don't turn out in anything like the numbers they turned out last time, it's hard for me to see how Obama carries Florida.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests are David Stebbin, professor of history and law at OSU, and also Jessica Palumbo. She's a reporter and producer for WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee, Florida. If you have a question or comment for them, we're looking forward to the debate tonight between President Barack Obama and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney in Boca Raton, Florida. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Jessica, what about enthusiasm in Florida? Because you mentioned that the Democrats are up 500,000 registrations.
Right.
What are they doing to get out the vote then?
Well, if you look historically, like you said, over the past 10 presidential elections, Democrats have always outnumbered Republicans in the state, yet Florida has swung Republican 7 out of the past 10 times. So there is sort of a lag sometimes between registrations and getting people out to the polls. The Obama campaign is, you know, says it's confident that they have the ground game that they need to keep people coming out. And that's especially important in Hillsborough County, which is the Tampa area where the Republicans held their national convention. That is sort of the battleground county within the battleground state where both campaigns are focusing a lot of attention, because that can go either way. It has a lot of diversity. It's sort of a microcosm of Florida. But again, the Obama campaign knows it cannot win Florida without the support of its young voters. Michelle Obama was in Tallahassee, where I am, earlier last month, and she said it, we can't win without you, the young, energetic voters who came out. And in 2008, when Obama won, the mood in Tallahassee was such of a large football victory. There were, you know, people partying in the streets, and experts are looking at it this time around and saying there is that enthusiasm lag.
They all graduated and went away, right? To a certain extent, yes. I mean, David,
my quip would be they've been underemployed for 4 years,
right.
a lot of them. And so that has a sobering effect. In other words, the initial premise was grand transformation. That's what would happen if Obama was elected. And things have changed, but this grand transformation thus far has not happened, right? And so it's harder to maintain that same level of enthusiasm. And the polls are really interesting on this nationally. In other words, if the polls are right, we'll have the lowest turnout on Election Day since 1976 and maybe since 1948. So that's a special kind of close election, close with low turnout. And so the question is, who can win the struggle against apathy?
Whose turnout is lower?
Right. That's right. And nobody knows. And of course, it really matters in the swing states most of all. Because even if Governor Romney's turnout in the Deep South is low, he's still going to carry those states.
Jessica mentioned the ground game, and in Ohio, that's profoundly different between the campaigns.
Right. The Obama campaign has invested heavily. There was a huge argument, actually, after the 2010 off-year elections that went so poorly for the Democrats here in Ohio, mm-hmm. and the president was here 16 or 17 times campaigning. In the end, it was sort of a wipeout. And the vice president's political team argued passionately that the Democrats could win in Ohio in 2012. And his team carried the day. And say what you want about Vice President Biden, he's a longtime career Democratic politician. He knows about elections. So they have invested very heavily in, for the Democrats anyway, in their ground operation here. And they think it's going to make the difference for them.
But not so much in Florida?
Right. It's hard. Florida's a big state. It's usually spread out. It has these very different parts of the state.
Right.
And so they have a ground operation in Florida, but it's not like Ohio's. But the assumption, I think, has been in the past 6 months that they're in better shape in Ohio, in part because of the economy. So it makes sense to devote more resources to Ohio. I was on the phone last night with a campaign operative working in the Boca Raton area about this. And he said, you know, I hardly see any stickers. You know, as a campaign worker, I can't get access to certain kinds of materials. Mm. Almost all the money has been spent on TV, that sort of thing. Whereas my impression is that it's somewhat different here, especially in central Ohio where we are, which is viewed as the swing city in the swing state.
Yeah, Jessica, in Ohio, there's something like 7 major media markets. I'm trying to get a fix on what's the comparables in Florida?
In Florida, you have Miami, you have Tampa, Orlando, and Jacksonville. Those are the main big media markets here. And like I said, most of that money, those television ad dollars, are going toward the Tampa market, where those voters are still undecided. And in Florida right now, polls indicate that up to 9% of voters are still undecided. And
that's above the national average then, right?
I believe so. But and in fighting against that apathy, those voters might not even come out to the polls. They might not decide. A lot of the young people who I've spoken with here in Tallahassee just say they don't really like either choice, and they're just planning to stay home.
Beth in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Hi. My comment is that the thing that really scares me about Romney and his courting of the South Florida Jewish vote is that how eager he is to go along with this invading Iran, and then we'll have like three. We already have enough on our plate on credit cards that we can't pay. You know, that wasn't even paid for, and it was just like, well, we'll worry about that later. And you really don't want to mess with Iran for obvious reasons, and that really scares me. So that's my comment.
Isn't it an either-or proposition for Jewish voters in Florida, Jessica? I mean, Paul's used the word nuanced. It's more nuanced than that. It's not that they want a president to go in and drop the bomb in Iran.
That's right. But Obama's been struggling with the Jewish voters, trying to show them that he has their back, and they've been straying away from him. So it'll be interesting. I think a lot of them in South Florida will be closely watching what he and Governor Romney say at tonight's debate.
Yeah, of many, many states out there, none more than Florida has these international ties.
Right. And there's also this, the largest single group of Jewish voters is in New York. The second largest is in California, but those states are not in play.
Right.
So Florida is by far the biggest state where there's a substantial Jewish presence, where it could, in a very close race, make a difference. So it's one of the weird things about this election is a lot of states are not contested. So in this final debate, where you're looking at that last 6% nationally, 9% in Florida, there'll be a lot of pressure on the candidates to tailor their remarks to this small number of states where there's a possibility of turnover. And that's a strange way to approach a national discussion about where we're going.
It sort of feels like the beginning of the primary.
Yes.
Phase. Do you agree, Jessica, with the focus on just a few states?
Yes, very much so.
Well, Jessica Palumbo, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Ann.
Jessica Palumbo, she's a reporter and producer for WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee, Florida. Coming up, we're going to hear from a public radio reporter in Colorado. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, never mind the American century, Ambassador and Gadfly Chaz Freeman says we're in nobody's century globally now, and we've got to learn a new way. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. And support for 89.7 comes from St. Joseph Montessori School, educating the human potential of Central Ohio students pre-K through 8th grade for more than 40 years. The school will be hosting an open house October 28th between 3 and 5 p.m. More information at sjms.net. Inspire, explore, celebrate. And support for 89.7 comes from Wesley Glen and Wesley Ridge Retirement Communities, offering independent and assisted living, dementia-specific programs, and nursing care. More on continuing care retirement communities at methodistelder.com. 55 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today warming up to a high of 76. Clouds for tonight, a low of 57. More sunshine for Tuesday with a high of 78 and sunny with a high of 79 on Wednesday. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Colorado is another swing state, although with significantly fewer electoral votes at stake, just 9, but they could be a crucial 9. Colorado went to Obama in 2008, but to the Republicans the previous 3 election cycles. So how might it turn out this time around? Joining us now is Megan Verlee. She's a reporter at Colorado Public Radio in Denver. Welcome to the show, Megan.
Hi there.
So Obama and Romney are within a percentage point of each other in Colorado. Early voting starts today there. What's the enthusiasm level out there? What are you expecting in terms of turnout?
Well, it's interesting. I think enthusiasm level and turnout may end up being two different things because of how hard the campaigns are working here. The enthusiasm is definitely not what it was 4 years ago, especially on the Obama side. I mean, we had the Democratic National Convention here with, you know, that a huge speech by him accepting the nomination in our football stadium.
Right.
He was bringing 50,000 people to rallies by the end of the campaign. And now, you know, I went to a rally a couple of weeks ago. It had 1,300 people at it, or no, 13,000 people at it. It's a good turnout, but not what we were seeing 4 years ago. The campaigns are aware of that, and so what you have is a massive ground game effort where they're going to get people turning in their ballots in spite of the potential lack of that kind of enthusiasm you saw 4 years ago. And the Romney campaign as well, they're planning bigger and bigger rallies, but really their strength is going to be on the ground going after individual voters, making sure those ballots get turned in.
Is this much attention being paid to Colorado typical? Is Colorado typically a swing state? I know it was a big deal 4 years ago because that's where the convention was and so forth, but is it typically swing?
It's getting swingier. it was a very reliably red state for a long time, but the demographic trends here have really moved it more towards the Democrats. A major influx of Latino voters who tend to go Democratic, and also a lot of younger, more liberal professionals moving into the state. I've talked with a couple of political science professors who say Colorado may not actually be a swing state much longer if those trends continue and those groups keep going Democratic. It may move reliably blue. But we're in a moment when not just presidential elections, but senatorial elections, statewide races go down really to the wire.
You mentioned the Latinos. When we were talking about Florida earlier, one of the issues there is, yes, they tend to go Democratic if they vote.
Yes, and again, a huge turnout effort to get them out by both campaigns, getting a lot of surrogates in the field, really trying to make sure that when they are convincing Latino voters, they're hearing it from another Latino, often hearing it in Spanish. And the hope is they might actually have a higher Latino turnout here than we did 4 years ago.
Now, early voting starts today. Has there been early voting in Colorado? I mean, is this a typical year? Ohio has been in a lot of, I don't know what you want to call it. There's been a lot of uproar in Ohio about when early voting was going to begin and end. Has that been a problem in Colorado?
Well, we have early voting here, but what actually is more important is mail-in ballots. The state has permanent mail-in voting, and there's been a controversy going on actually since about this time or last year about whether mail-in voters who didn't vote in the 2010 election were going to get mail-in ballots automatically for this election. Our Secretary of State, who is a Republican, in fact was the top Republican campaign lawyer before he won the position, has maintained that under state rules, they cannot get ballots because they're considered inactive voters. A lot of clerks, especially the Democratic clerks, feel that's unfair. If you put your name on something called the permanent mail-in voting list, they feel people expect to get a ballot. And especially with 2010 being a Republican wave year, much lower Democratic turnout, there is a lot of concern among Democrats that a good chunk of their voters are expecting to get these mail-in ballots and aren't going to see them. So you've seen a tremendous effort, less with getting people to the polls for early voting, more with, did you get a mail-in ballot? If you didn't get a mail-in ballot, you got to get to the polls to vote. We're going to, you know, make you aware of your status.
You know, David, I grew up in, you know, the olden days when voting was the most basic, easiest. We knew the voting. Everybody knew when to vote. They knew where to vote. They knew certainly who they were going to vote for, all things being equal. Now it's every year, one state or another or many, there's a lot of confusion. And I'm wondering, how does that play out in the final analysis?
Well, there are a lot of different considerations. The options, voting options have expanded. In the olden days, not that you're olden, but in an earlier era, to vote by mail, absentee, you had to be absent from the state during the election. And so the old rule of thumb was, if the margin of victory depends on absentee ballots, the Republicans almost always win, especially in a Midwestern state where it's sort of class-specific, upper-income voters are more likely to be away and they're Republican. Once you open the door to large numbers of people voting early by mail who never leave, right, just to make it more convenient, mm-hmm. that introduces issues. If you introduce required ID, Americans are a busy, distracted people. All these new technologies have made them more distracted. So oftentimes people have expired ID or they don't have it at all, or if they're a senior living in a nursing home, their driver's license has expired, and their children are very happy that it's expired because they don't want granny driving around town at age 85. But it creates new issues, and so it's more complicated than it used to be. The other thing that's changed is that the parties have changed in ways that make people not entirely as sure. In other words, you're old enough to remember when the Democratic and Republican electorates in Ohio were more stable in some ways. They do these studies of places like Youngstown, Ohio, where for an earlier generation of New Deal Democrats, they were very wedded to the Democratic Party. Since the 60s, there's a lot more ambivalence about the stands of the two major parties. For the Republicans, the challenge in a state like Colorado, it's interesting. The Republicans used to be a strong party in the West, mm-hmm. generally. As the Republican Party has become ever more heavily based in the South, a lot of Western states have become less Republican. California is the supreme example of this. It's no longer a Republican state at all. It used to be. And Colorado is now one of these tipping kinds of states. So there still are reliably Republican states in the Mountain West, to be sure. But if you have a fairly substantial proportion of the electorate that lives in a major metropolitan area like Denver, then the Republican Party is not really the party of major metropolitan voters outside the South. And so that's what's happened in a state like Colorado.
Give us a call if you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org as well. Once again, it's David Stebbin, professor of history and law at OSU, and also Megan Verley. She's a reporter for Colorado Public Radio. We're doing a little preview of the third and final presidential debate tonight in Boca Raton, Florida. Megan, the Denver Post last week endorsed Barack Obama for president. One of the issues raised in its endorsement was that of energy and Mitt Romney's promise to drill at any cost is in contrast. And the fact that his promise to drill at any cost is in contrast to what the Denver Post called the predominant view in Colorado that balances energy, environment and environment. And I know you've covered everything from conservation programs on the Eastern Plains to natural gas development on the Western Slope. Do issues like that really matter in Colorado, or is it more a matter of jobs and the economy like in so much of the rest of the country?
Well, I think the two are inextricably entwined out here, actually. We have a very large energy sector, and it has had a rough time. Natural gas bottomed out during the recession, and you saw massive layoffs. So there are parts of the state that are clawing back from that, and they really do want to see an increased attention to drilling on public lands. At the same time, we have a very strong sportsman and outdoors community that, you know, you put drill rigs out in the national forest, you're not hunting elk near those for a couple of years. You put them near trails, you're not going to have people hiking in the pristine backcountry. So there's been a tension about which industry is more long-term sustainable for Colorado's growth. And there's also a growing concern about natural gas development near urban communities on the Front Range of Colorado. It's very interesting, Romney's focus on how the growth has been on private land. We've seen a lot of that out here in the last year or two, in large part because of where new deposits are being found. And what you have is a Front Range population that is increasingly concerned about pro-drilling policies and what that means for having drill rigs very close to their homes and schools. I'm not sure how many of those folks would have ever been Romney supporters, but I think they are extremely sensitized to the idea of a policy that prioritizes drilling above anything else.
I would imagine there's something of a split, though, in, say, the sportsman sector.
Definitely. And going back to gun rights and a great concern about that Obama might push gun restrictions in his second term, the sportsman's community has definitely been divided because, you know, they'll side with environmentalists on development issues, and then they'll, you know, go back towards the Republican Party for gun control. And you know, I think it'll be interesting to see how they break down on those two issues.
I mentioned that one percentage point difference in Colorado. How much did the first debate impact the race in Colorado, do you think?
It really tightened it up. You know, as with much of the rest of the country, the narrative in Colorado going into that debate was that this was more and more Obama's election. It was going to look more and more like 2008. I was actually in the media center for that debate at the University of Denver, and watching the tweets and just feeling sort of the atmosphere in the room. In the first 10 minutes, it was this growing sense of, who's at the Obama lectern? This is not the guy we expected to see. And by the end of the debate, you just had the feeling of people walking out that this is going to be a different race. And, well, Obama came back the next morning with a very large rally in Denver and, you know, really unveiled a new line of attack on Romney. It tightened up the race considerably. And, you know, people in the state were watching very closely. There was a lot of excitement that the debate was being held in our state. And so I think the effect might have been magnified, and it just, man, everything tightened up very quickly afterwards.
David, is it pretty much?
That's right. These first debates tend to count for more than others because first impressions are lasting, and the president's performance was lackluster. That's, I think, even the first lady would agree with that comment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's made it more close and exciting, you know, if you're someone who's a pundit who watches this, but it's also made a lot of these close states much less predictable. And so it ramps up the emphasis on, you know, promoting turnout, using the ground game as much as you can. Another thing that's interesting about, two more things, actually, they're interesting about Colorado. One, I agree with everything that the other guest said about the sort of differences in the electorate on things like outdoorsmanship versus energy development. Colorado is the kind of state that derives a significant amount of income from tourism. And if you're that kind of a state, unrestricted drilling is a problem. Even beyond the recreators who are homegrown, who enjoy being out in the natural environment, the skiers and so on who come from elsewhere. So it creates more of a tension even within the business community, because if you generate your income from tourism, you're more phobic about energy exploration that gets in the way of that tourism. The other thing I'd say about Colorado that's interesting is that, like other Mountain West states, it has a significant Mormon presence in the electorate.
Yep.
Not large, but if it's going to be 50-50, really close, then that could be the tipping thing for Governor Romney in Colorado.
Megan, agreed?
Definitely. A significant Mormon presence, and also, but sort of counterbalancing it, a fairly significant libertarian population. And I think that is one thing I would imagine the Romney campaign is concerned about, that Gary Johnson might get a few more votes in this state than he would in others, and, you know, could have something of a Nader effect, pulling off just enough to tilt that margin.
What do you think, Megan, are Colorado voters looking for when the candidates visit this week and, and then also in their debate tonight?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of interest in the conversation around defense and defense spending. Colorado is a fairly heavily military, we have a fairly heavy military presence, especially in Colorado Springs, which is a very red area already. But we have a lot of defense contractors in the aerospace industry. They've been really hurt by the uncertainty around sequestration and the fiscal cliff and what's going to happen with the defense budget. And so I think you are going to see a lot of people looking to see where the candidates are talking about changing that spending. And then, you know, jobs in the economy is such a nice broad phrase for the uncertainty people feel about the country's fiscal future. So I think that the few undecided voters we have left are looking for that last little bit of reassurance about the candidate they might already be leaning towards, that yes, I can trust what they're saying. I can trust what I like about them. I can, you know, check that box on my ballot and finally move on.
Yeah, you know, David Sebin, we really haven't talked about foreign affairs in terms of defense spending and that whole issue of defense and who's stronger.
And it's very interesting because Governor Romney has staked out this position as being the more enthusiastic about military spending. And the interesting question is, if he does that in this debate, does it provide President Obama a chance to bring in some sense, his best critique, which is that the numbers don't add up? In other words, it's supposed to be about foreign policy and national security, but if there's an emphasis, I'll spend significantly more on our military, then does the president come back with, well, that just expands the size of the deficit and creates other problems and weakens us in other ways in the world. And so you could see this sort of spillover where a debate that's mostly supposed to, or entirely supposed to be about foreign policy, ends up being partly a debate again about the proper plan for the federal budget going forward. And that happened in 08. In other words, the economic problems hit big time right around the time of that debate that was focused between McCain and Obama about foreign policy. And so domestic economic concerns entered via that way. In other words, that this is another threat to America's standing in the world. So if that happens, I think that helps the president in some ways. In other words, the problem for Governor Romney incredibly arguing for a lot more defense spending is, where does the money come from to pay for this? Mm-hmm. And he doesn't yet have a fully persuasive answer on that point. So we'll see if he comes up with one tonight.
See, Megan, we're just got about 45 seconds left, but you know, we're always talking about what the weather's like on voting day in Ohio, and I remember skiing in Colorado on October 31st one year. So I'm wondering, how much does weather play into it, or is that the whole idea behind the mail-in ballot in the first place?
I think that's a big part of it. Is the majority of Coloradans are expected to vote before Election Day. We're actually starting to talk about election season out here. And I think for both campaigns, this focus on checking people off, making sure they've gotten their ballot in early, does have a lot to do with not getting that freak blizzard, you know, showing up on the wrong Tuesday. And as you know, that can happen almost any time past Labor Day in Colorado.
Exactly. Well, thanks for joining us, Megan, today.
Thank you.
Megan Verlee, she's a reporter for Colorado Public Radio. Also, David Sebin, professor of history and law at The Ohio State University. David, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.